I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing Richard Linklater's latest, Last Flag Flying, and speaking to one of the film's stars, the great Bryan Cranston. I'm Sam Howlett, and flying the flag with me this week are Ryan Hewitt.
Hello.
And Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
How you doing, guys?
Very well, thank you, Sam.
Okay, thank you, Sam.
Stephen, what have you been up to this week?
I watched a Blu-ray recently that I got sent as a screener. Of an Armenian film from the 70s called The Color of Pomegranates. It's quite a well-known film. It got voted, I think, like in the 60s, 62nd in Sight and Sounds, greatest films of all time, poll, the last one that came out. And it's an incredibly striking film, but it's one about basically a poet whose name I've forgotten now, but he was an Armenian poet from 17th century Armenia who... a lot of his songs are still sung in Armenia, and a lot of the kind of rituals and religious practices that he must have gone through at the time were kind of put onto screen. But it's visually it's absolutely incredible, but there's so many of these images that I have no idea what's going on in them, and it's a very like poetic kind of surreal film, Bunuelian in a lot of ways, a little bit of Tarkovsky in there, and I really didn't know what to make of it. It was an odd thing to start off my viewing with this week, and I'm going to have to write a review of it soon. I really don't have any idea where to start. but it was certainly something. And it looks great on Blu-ray too. Martin Scorsese worked on it with the Film Foundation. Cool. And okay. He's a huge fan of this movie. I think him and Godard have both spoken about, like, if you really want to know about film history, then you should watch this one. So yeah, it's fascinating, but I'm not sure whether I liked it or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's it called again?
The Color of Pomegranates.
So if you want to know about film history, you have to watch.
You have to see this. I think Godard said that you, in order to really enjoy this movie, you have to find a cinema 15 miles away and walk there. So yeah, it's that kind of film.
Yeah.
It was played last year at Curzon Soho.
Right. Okay.
On 35mm, if I'm not mistaken, part of the Fashion and Film Festival.
Ah, that makes sense. Yeah. The costume design is incredible.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. No, that makes absolute sense. I can't imagine the work that must have gone into it, but you know, it's so difficult to make a film in general that, you know, that's why we see so many safe films being made, because people are like, look, if we're going to make it, let's make sure it plays to people.
Yeah.
So to make a film like about an Armenian poet, which is completely surreal and doesn't really have any connection to other kinds of filmmaking, it's a bold move.
Yeah.
In the 70s. It's a bold move. So yeah,
I feel like I watched the opposite film over the weekend in every way. I watched Brawl in Cell Block 99, which is S. Craig Zahler's follow-up to Bone Tomahawk, which I love, really like Bone Tomahawk. This played at LFF, but I missed it, and then I picked it up on Blu-ray over the weekend and watched it Saturday night. And me oh my, is this a violent film? So Vince Vaughn, the comedy actor Vince Vaughn, plays a drug runner who seems to be only in the criminal underworld to satisfy and make a family with his wife, who he really loves, and he's got this very sort of anti-violent sentiment. And then he's sent to prison, and while he's in there, he's threatened with some of his former associates from the outside, saying, "You have to kill this person in prison, or we'll kill your wife." So the film is him fighting his way to cell block 99. To get this guy, and
pregnant wife as well. If
pregnant
I'm not mistaken,
wife, correct.
Yeah. That's another layer.
The stakes are very high.
The stakes are very high, and how they threaten the pregnant wife is very unpleasant indeed.
Yes, that's true.
And I didn't see the first 98, so could come. Sorry. Have you guys both seen this?
I've seen it. Yeah, I saw it at LFF in a double bill of hyper-violent prison-related movies. I saw it like 6 o'clock and then straight after went and saw A Prayer Before Dawn.
Right.
Which was in stark contrast tonally to this film. But Broad and Cellblock 99, I thought it was great fun. But yeah, to be perfectly honest, it didn't go as bonkers as I wanted it to go.
Okay.
I thought this is going to go like melee, like crazy, hyper-violent.
Yeah.
Like, but it was so it was quite restrained, I thought.
For a while, all of the violence.
Yeah.
Sort of
a couple of people. You know, obviously it's very gory, but it's like small rooms and it's one or two people and it's very intimate and close quarters, isn't it? It's very brutal. But I was kind of, hoping for a bit more like...
The Raid 2.
Absolute insanity,
I think there is some, because S. Craig Zahler, I think he knows that people really want what you're talking about from this film. They want to see blood spattering on the walls and bones breaking every 5 minutes. And he gives that to you, but he makes you wait for it.
Yeah.
In a 2-hour film, and you know the poster is Vince Vaughn in a prison jumpsuit. Mm. The film's called Brawl in Soul 99. It takes him about an hour to get into prison. First of all,
it does,
and then another 40 minutes to get to Cellblock 99. So it really makes you wait, and I quite liked that about it. I think it made you know Vince Vaughn as a character before you see what he has to go through, because they set him. I think they go out of their way to set him up as a kind of person with a moral compass, maybe not very subtly at all, and maybe they go out too far out of their way to do that. But I think there's a point there that they set that up.
I think you're right. I think the film really wants this character to be the centerpiece of the film, and it wants you to kind of, you know, rally around him and really get on board with what he's doing. My issue is I don't think Vince Vaughn is a strong enough actor to carry a 2-hour film, especially one like this where, as a physical presence, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's, all that muscle just for show.
He's a big guy. You know, he's a big dude anyway, right? He's
just
over 6 foot, like quite a bit over 6 foot. And and I think he certainly has a presence in the film. But when he's asked to make you feel, you know, his kind of trepidation and his need to save his wife, I wasn't buying it that much.
Okay.
No, but I have to say the last 20 minutes did really have me on the edge of my seat. If not just for the sheer violence of it alone and not knowing what was going to come next, it was. I preferred Bone Tomahawk, but it was like that final scene in Bone Tomahawk like turned up for a little bit longer, extended a little bit.
Bone Tomahawk's another one that's I think it's like well over 2 hours long, Bone Tomahawk, and incredibly slow film until the last 15, 20 minutes or so where just chaos erupts on screen. And it really, I think it makes a big difference because you really get to know and feel these characters and the relationships between them, that when someone is getting ripped in half, it's not just someone getting ripped in half, it's that person getting ripped in half. I think that's the difference.
Well, the cast for Bone Tomahawk was incredibly strong. I mean, you had Richard Jenkins in there.
You did, yeah.
Matthew Fox was fantastic in it.
Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell's in it. You
Patrick
know,
Wilson.
Patrick Wilson, all these actors are... All of them are better than Vince Vaughn. That's the problem, I think. But it's going to be interesting to see what Zahler does next as well. You know about his next film. It's called Dragged Across Concrete. It's starring who's...
So it's got pretty much the same cast as Brawl in Cellblock 99. So Vince Vaughn's back. Jennifer Carpenter, who plays his wife here, she's back in it. I think Udo Kier.
Oh, wonderful.
Makes another appearance.
Wonderful.
I'm pretty sure Don Johnson as well, who plays the warden of Cellblock 99. Mel Gibson as well joins that cast. They play two policemen who are fired for police brutality. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then join the criminal underworld to make some extra money.
Credit to him. I don't think I agree with his politics, but I think that S. Craig Zahler, he seems to be pushing against a lot of stuff we're seeing today, and it's kind of fascinating to see a filmmaker do that and to be given these kind of budgets in this space to do that. I'm not sure I like it, but it's very interesting, you know.
Well, we could talk about this for another 40 minutes, I think, but it's time to move on to our film of the week. So, Last Flag Flying sees three ex-Vietnam buddies. So, Doc Shepard, played by Steve Carell, Sal Neeland, played by Bryan Cranston, and Richard Mueller, played by Lawrence Fishburne. They are reunited when Doc's son is killed in the Iraq War, and when Doc decides to move his son from Arlington Military Cemetery so he can have a civilian funeral, the three go on a cross-country road trip. But before we discuss the film, it's time for this week's guest, Heisenberg himself, Mr. Bryan Cranston. Stephen, you spoke to him.
I did, yeah.
How was
gentleman.
He?
He's absolutely lovely. He took time out of his day, actually. He's got a busy schedule at the moment with Network, playing at the National Theatre, sold out shows. And yeah, he was great.
Okay, so we apologize if you hear a glass breaking towards the end, but it took place in a bar. So this is Stephen and Brian Cranston. Enjoy.
So here we are in the Curzon Mayfair bar with Brian Cranston. Thank you for coming along just before you head up
pleasure.
The stage.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
No, that's fantastic. I saw Last Fly Flying at the London Film Festival. I thought it was an incredibly impressive film. I guess it's a good way to start would be to ask you how you came to the project and what it's like kind of working with a director you can never really pigeonhole or pin down.
That's true,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Richard Linklater does such a wide variety of films because he has a wide variety of tastes, like a lot of us do, but mm-hmm. he gets to be able to express himself in doing that. So he does a film like School of Rock, Dazed and Confused, yep, yep. Boyhood,
yeah.
And it seems like those are from three different minds.
Oh, incredibly so. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
And then you remember Bernie?
I do. Bernie's one of those, it's a deep cut Linklater, but it's certainly one that I loved it when it came out.
And, beautiful films.
And he has this habit as well, talking about Bernie, he has this habit of working with actors who have an incredibly kind of comic sense to them, but are still capable of doing drama. And I think that's something that you've always, in your career, been, you know, excellent at.
Well, thank you. I mean, I've always wanted to be able to be versatile in the work that I'm doing, and so I've been very fortunate. So in Breaking Bad there were comedic moments, mm-hmm. albeit dark.
Mm-hmm.
In Malcolm in the Middle there were dramatic moments.
Absolutely.
And then that's what I look for in films. So Last Flag Flying was sent to me, and I was told that Richard was interested in Steve and Lawrence for the other roles. And when I read it, I was immediately taken by not just the humor and not just the road trip aspect of it, about the bonding essence of men and how we regain friendship, how we deal with grief, and all of that. But also the humor was just all there. So
that's what surprised me the most about the film, you know, like it's I was going to say, actually, out of all the films at the London Film Festival, even the comedies, I did not laugh harder than the train scene between you guys. Those belly laughs that come in from you all. Was that scripted?
Yes, it was.
It was all scripted. It wasn't. None of it was.
I can't say none of it was improvisation. But no, Rick has a very keen ear towards what strikes him funny, and then cast it with people who get it and know that humor. And it was fun to do. So, yes, there were lines, I'm sure, that we all threw in at different times. And I'm at this point, I couldn't tell you what was, but I do know that it was almost entirely scripted, but the physicality wasn't scripted. You can't say then he lies back on and does this and does, unless it's very specific to telling a joke.
So it almost seemed as though when Steve doubled over at one point that you reacted to it as he doubled over and kept on laughing more, and I just thought it was it was great because it felt like, you know, at that point in time a lot of emotions were coming out in that scene from you guys and you were all relaxing with each other, but at the same time it still felt very sad. There's a melancholy aspect, I think, to Last Flag Flying, and the friendship part of it, I think, is a huge, huge part of that. You know, watching them come back together, it's those relationships starting up again is incredibly moving and melancholic. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a beautiful story, beautifully handled by Steve and Lawrence in their roles, and Rick being the maestro.
Absolutely.
It was amazing. We did have 3 weeks of rehearsal before we started, and it was incredibly valuable to be able to just read through it, the four of us, for most of it, and Rick would go away, come back the next day with some rewrites, and go away and come back with more rewrites, and almost like a group therapy session. We would talk and have lunch, and we'd say, well, you know, I'm having a problem with this scene for this reason or another, and then someone else will go, yeah, now that you mentioned it, I do too, and so we kind of needed each other to be able to bounce off each other and build, to take something apart and then rebuild it.
Yeah.
And Rick has a lot of confidence, so he wasn't daunted by that task.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. What I'm really intrigued about is, obviously, with Network, you've been spending quite a lot of time in England at the moment, so you're going to be kind of the culture, you're going to be exploring it a little bit. And considering that Last Flag Flying is a movie about, for me, a big part of it is about patriotism and what it means to be a patriot, and whether that's a personal, spiritual thing or it's something you can define. And in England and in the US, do you think Last Flag Flying is a film that's going to be received quite differently in these countries? Or do you think it does have a universal kind of aspect to it?
I hope so. I think it does span the globe more than be so idiosyncratic to any one country. It's about nobility. It's about service. It's about making choices. It's about family, because the military really is just a large family.
Yeah.
And like a family, you can criticize it all you want when you're in it. But someone outside the family can't say a word about it. And so you'll see ex-military or current military complain about their assignments or duties or an officer or something. And that's so common. It just happens within that familial structure. But then you still go about and you do your job.
So
you can bitch and complain, but then you go about and do it. And there's nobility in that. And these three men, despite their hardships and perhaps poor decision-making on how they handled their own PTSD and troubles, there is nobility to them, in each in their own way.
Yeah.
Even Sal, my character.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Sal is... you might not think that at first, but by the time the film finishes, and especially in that last scene, you see how much it means to him. The journey aspect of the film and how much it means to him that he's been able to kind of like... Well, I wouldn't want to say complete the journey, but for him to go through that, you definitely see it. Yeah, you definitely see it. And I think what I find so interesting about it is that kind of, because being an Englishman myself, like the American Army is something that's quite foreign to me. But for you, was it something that you had to research, or do you have a personal connection to the Army in America, the Armed Forces?
Not specifically the Army. My father was in the Navy Air Corps in World War II. My mother was in the United States Coast Guard, also another branch of the service here. And so I come from that military family. Mm. And although I didn't serve, it was an automatic for my parents' generation because they were fighting a clear and present danger. Whereas in my day, I was a little too young to be drafted for Vietnam, but it was different. Vietnam, we were told things that have now proven to be not true. We have been manipulated to a great degree, propagandized, and it's okay and appropriate to question your military leaders, your political leaders, to make sure that they have every single young boy and young woman in mind before they put them in harm's way. That diplomacy should always go to the very end, and military action should be the absolute last resort of any kind of conflict resolution.
And I think Sal almost personifies that, holding people to account in the film. He has that in him. He wants to make sure that it's held to account. He doesn't hate the Army. He doesn't have anything particularly. There's no hatred there, but he certainly.
Well, I think there is some hatred there. He has hatred, but he also has a deep love. It's very complicated, his relationship with it, and just like a family, when you have these love-hate relationships that are so rooted and so vital to that person's history, to that person's even self-worth. But Sal is a guy who feels like, as he says in the movie, the only color that he sees is green, which is the color of the Marine Corps. You know, and it's like, that's all I see. That's when he was the most alive, I think. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you ever so much, Brian.
Thank you.
And thank you for taking time out from Network as well.
I appreciate it. Good to see you, man. Thank you.
You too.
So this film is
it's quite hard to describe to people in terms of the context of it, because it's kind of a sequel to The Last Detail, but it also isn't. It's based on a book by Don Ponickson, and that book is a sequel to The Last Detail, but here Richard Linklater has changed the name of the characters from the book to make this its own film, but spiritually, I guess it is a sequel to The Last Detail. That's the way I read it. I think that's the way it's been sold to us as well.
This idea of like a spiritual sequel, it's something that keeps coming up with Linklater, though, isn't it?
It does,
yeah.
Everybody
the
wants
king
some
of spiritual sequels.
Yeah, that's a sequel, I guess, to both Dazed and Confused, very much a sequel to that film, because that film's kids in their last week of high school, and Everybody Wants Some is the first week of college. So you could view that. That could very easily be the same group of characters. And then Boyhood as well ends with the lead character going to college.
Yeah.
And this could, you know, this could easily be his first week of college. So yeah, it's nice to view it in that way as well. So Linklater's first road movie, his first film in 10 years that isn't an original screenplay from him. He did adapt it with Dan Ponickson. Fresh off the bat then, what did you guys think of the film?
I enjoyed the film a lot. I think it had all the hallmarks of a Richard Linklater, and that's very reflective and quite gentle about its approach to the philosophy of life. And people were being introspective and all the things that you want from a Richard Linklater, really. They weren't quite the protracted monologues of people like picking apart something that's just happened. But it was very self-aware, and the characters are very self-aware. And that's what's always so enjoyable for me about Richard Linklater's films. Perhaps a little, a bit more like Everybody Wants Some. There's still this like raucousness or a boisterousness to the characters. It's definitely a very male film. And, you know, kind of loving that it's maleness and really having some fun with this like this rabble of guys who are reminiscing, and it's recalling things like Last Orders and all that idea of a bunch of guys getting together and finding their common ground that's been lost over the last three decades in this case. And I think, it's again preoccupied with this idea of the passing of time and how unstoppable time is, which is something that Linklater's
that's his jam.
That is him.
I mean, almost all of his last four or five films have all been about that kind of. He's so good at kind of measuring time on screen through his characters, through these kind of like, I know in Last Flag Flying, there's these melancholic shots of like cities and trains moving and things like that. They're so beautifully composed, but they're just there as kind of placeholders, as fillers for like between scenes. But he's so good at that. And I've never quite been able to pin down how he manages to put this concept of the passage of time on screen so well, especially in Last Flag Flying. I think you, on Bryan Cranston's face, on Steve Carell's face, on Lawrence Fishburne's face, you see their age, and you see their like the past catching up with them really quickly. And I think they all play it beautifully well, actually. Especially Carell, such a restrained performance.
Very restrained, yeah.
As the father, taking his son back to where he needs to be. And he seems to be just barreling between roles at the moment, Carell, that are like outlandish, kind of over-the-top roles, like in Battle of the Sexes, to something like this. And it's impressing me more and more every time, actually.
I think this is it. Carell in particular is a brilliant piece of casting in this, because you spend... Well, I spend the whole film looking at him, thinking, you're a funny guy.
Yeah.
You're a comedic actor. And that is all drained from you in this film. There's no sign of it, which is, of course, appropriate for his role. He's a grieving father.
Yeah.
But because of who Carell is, you're so aware that there's something missing from this character. Mm-hmm. It's something has been sapped.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And you couldn't get that with... say if Bryan Cranston or Lawrence Fishburne were playing the role of Doc,
yeah,
I don't think it would have the same impact, because although they're funny guys, perfectly capable of doing comedy, they're not comedic actors in my mind. They are more broad.
They're actors with comic sensibility, I think. Yeah.
And everything about how he looks as well, like the sort of the neat little moustache, very standard glasses, the way he sort of combs his hair over, and the big sort of raincoat he wears as well,
coat,
sort of oversized for him. Everything about him is just screams like shy, quiet, sad.
To go into a little bit detail about the film, my favorite scene in the whole film is the scene on the train between the four men, the three of them and the young soldier, talking about the past. That's the one moment that Steve Carell is kind of allowed to let go a little bit and show some some happiness for the first time in the film. And honestly, like of all the films, like I said this to.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
To Brian in the interview, out of all the films I saw at the London Film Festival, it just had me laughing so hard. And it was almost a relief, laughter of relief, seeing Steve Carell just breaking down, tears of laughter and tears of joy. was so good and so real. And it was that classic Linklater where you see it and he has this ability to, you know, these guys are actors and you know they're playing roles, but you can't help get sucked into the scene itself and kind of feel exactly what they're feeling. And I think it's such a talent that he has. Yeah.
Okay. And then Bryan Cranston, then kind of in the opposite sense, he's very broad in this film, but in a really great way. And his character is the equivalent of the Jack Nicholson character from The Last Detail.
Yeah.
And there is a kind of Nicholson-esque about him in this film, I think. Did any of you pick up on that? Or was that just because I knew it? I'm not sure.
He's a trickster, isn't he?
I think we're probably looking for some Nicholson, but I definitely found it. It definitely felt like he was channeling Nicholson. Although in a Q&A, he said that he deliberately didn't go and watch The Last Detail before because he, quote, didn't want Jack Nicholson running around my head. Or the last thing I want is Jack Nicholson running around my head.
Nobody wants that.
Yeah. And but I think it's hard not to project that onto him. And if he is doing that, he does a really good job of it. It's not a caricature performance.
Not at all.
And it's definitely still Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
But it has that wild unpredictability of Nicholson.
Yeah, and the way he looks as well is great. That his hair is always this kind of disheveled, his beard is sort of uneven and grizzly. He just wears these plain grey, badly fitting t-shirts and this
Budweiser t-shirt.
Yeah, and this sort of this leather jacket that looks like he's owned since Vietnam. and the bar he owns as well is just so messy.
I love that bar.
It's a really cool
set.
Yeah.
It really had a sense of a man who did not know how to run a bar.
Yeah.
which is really great. I wondered how you guys felt about the fact that it was set in the early 2000s as well. And we're seeing, we don't get to see that many films.
Yeah,
there's not a lot of there's not a lot of nostalgia for the early 2000s at this point in time.
Yeah.
I felt like they did a really good job of capturing the sense of time, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Especially the scene with the phone.
The phones.
They're very confused about how mobile phones work. I love that scene.
Buying a contract for the first time.
Yeah.
It's such a good thing that Linklater does. He did it with Boyhood as well, where he will treat things in recent memory as though they are of as much weight as something from 40 years ago. And in this film, you hear them playing this Eminem song, which was the point that really dated it. They put the radio on and Without Me comes on.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow, this is 2003 all over again. He did it with Boyhood. You know, you have like Coldplay songs coming in and all these things that feel so current because I suppose if you can remember it, the first time around, it doesn't feel like the past.
Yeah,
exactly. It doesn't feel like history. It just feels like what happened a few years ago.
Absolutely.
But he treats everything like history.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. You're right. Maybe that's why he's got such a good kind of connection with the passage of time, because he is able to kind of figure out very easily what makes us nostalgic, even if it is just that split second of hearing a song or seeing a film title or seeing a poster or something like that. And he manages to hone in on it really, really easily, which is great, which is really good stuff.
And it makes it different from Everybody Wants Some as well, which is viewing the early 1980s in this very bright coloured, rose tinted view of the 1980s, yeah. Whereas this feels a very real view of 2003 without being too nostalgic or too sort of judgmental of that era. It just feels like this is very, everyone has a very sort of 2003 mentality to it. That's really nicely captured.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, and that's reflected in what you said about the costume, because, yeah, everybody wants some, is everyone's dressed like...
Yeah, it's like a costume
like
party.
Classic. Yeah, yeah, it might be, yeah. You go to a themed
very
party
tight,
themed
yeah, very
in the
80s.
Yeah. Whereas these guys are all fairly nondescript in their style. I mean, Bryan Cranston, there's a suggestion that he's been dressing like that for the last 30 years. And Steve Carell is just ordinary... bloke, and then of course you've got the Reverend, so he but nobody is really dated by what they're wearing because they're all out of fashion anyway. They're not trendy guys.
No, they're not supposed to be.
So the cues come from things like Eminem and comes from little looks at newsreel footage, and of course the Iraq War, which is a shadow of over everything and what's driving
the
narrative.
Well, that's for me was the most interesting thing about the film was the fact that we had this idea. I mean, you guys just heard in the interview, the listeners just heard in the interview how Brian talked a little bit about how he saw the army as a family, and when you're in the family, you can talk about them whichever way you want. But if anybody else talks about them badly, then you can, you know, go. But this by the end of the film, I was struck by the idea that I think it's a bold move in today's political climate to make a film about patriotism and what that means to the individual rather than what it means to a country. I wonder how you guys felt about that.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, you and Brian talked about this in a really nice way. And I liked how the film kind of, it respects the kind of pride of a soldier. Although, like you said, the individuals that served, while at the same time, it does question the government that has let them down and it criticizes the government as a body, but there's nothing lobbied at the soldier or anyone who served in the military, which was that's a nice sort of line to walk across, I think. It does it quite confidently and quite easily.
I think it challenges the idea of government quite a lot. I mean, Bryan Cranston's character is repeatedly talking about the idea of truth.
Yeah.
And there's this constant wrestling with, the awkward thing about the truth is that it's true and that it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And he's so adamant at points that you have to tell the truth. We have to know the truth about what happened in Iraq to your son, Doc. And later on, things change, don't they? And he's not so sure that the truth is the right way forward. And it's this... That feels very relevant now.
I think so. This idea of a safe fiction versus a hard truth.
Yeah.
What's the best route to go down? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And by the end of the film, I don't think we are entirely sure if his mind is made up, but he does know for a fact that this journey he's taken with his friend has been a worthwhile journey.
Yeah,
which is, and you feel that as an audience in the final scene, which I won't spoil. But it's a fantastic final scene, which I think Linklater as he continues to mature as a filmmaker, he seems to be getting those final scenes. Yeah. They seem to be getting better and better for me. He knows how to finish a movie at this point.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. not a lot of directors do these days.
No. So the third member then of this old gang is Lawrence Fishburne as the Reverend Robert Mueller. I really loved him in this film quite a lot, actually. I love the way, so I've been talking about how they all look. So I guess how Fishburne looks, he has this kind of like snowflake beard.
Yeah.
And this like gentle white hair. He looks very sort of gentle and grandfatherly. Mm-hmm. And so he has this big coat that's buttoned up all the way, very smart, sensible coat. You can just about see his reverend's collar at the top. He has this cane. He wears these sort of library little glasses. Yeah. But then he can sort of switch very quickly to his old self, the way he sort of gets angry at Bryan Cranston's character. And that's a really nice performance. And the way he switches. Mm-hmm. I had a great time with him in this film.
Yeah, Mueller the Mauler.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that was his nickname. Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, he's great, though. I think he delivers some of the lines that Linklater's written for him really well. The line in the trailer where they want to let the coffin go, and he says, they're saying, oh, you can only get it released by a member of the army. And then he turns around and he's like, or a clergyman. He delivered that really well, you know, because that's the bit where he turns and he thinks, I do need to be here for my friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which was great, absolutely. He's a different presence in the film to both of them.
Yeah.
Completely different. He's very much the voice of reason for a long time, and it's needed. It's really needed. Mm. But Lawrence Fishburne's an actor who I don't think we see enough on our screens.
No. Well, he could be the same character he plays in Apocalypse Now, couldn't he?
I forgot he was in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As when he used to go by Larry Fishburne as well. He's credited as Larry Fishburne. Larry Fishburne. So he's grown up now. He's Lawrence.
Yeah, he's Lawrence now. I prefer Lawrence.
Yeah.
I prefer Lawrence. Yeah, absolutely. No, but he is great in it. And I hadn't thought a lot about the looks of these characters, actually. And you're right. You guys are right. It's such a huge part of the film, the way that they look. Yeah.
It really defines the different ways that they've all reacted to their trauma of Vietnam. It never really puts a label on it as saying these guys had been traumatized by what happened in Vietnam.
Yeah.
They talk about awful things that have happened and allude to really unpleasant incidents. But no one says you have PTSD.
No.
But it's suggested that Bryan Cranston's character, Sal, in particular, is dealing with it in a kind of self-medicating, alcoholic way. And Lawrence Fishburne's Mueller has turned to God and found some kind
of peace
within that. And Steve Carell feels like the character that's lost and doesn't really know how to...
Steve Carell's character was the one that got discharged, right?
He was.
Yeah.
And the other two didn't?
No.
Did they? They stayed in the army, right?
And I believe
it was
so.
I can't remember if the movie directly addresses it. I can't recall, but it was because they were messing around with Doc's supply of medicine, I think. And they took some of the medicine and he was the one that got blamed for it. So in a way, I guess they feel like... owe him.
Yeah, totally.
I think Steve Carell certainly seems like you said, he's missing something. Something's emptied out of him.
Yeah.
And the other two, I guess, spend a lot of the film trying to fill that void. I like to think that they managed to do it. You know?
I think so. I think you're right. There's a real sense that Carell's character never recovered from the war because he got thrown in the brig and effectively had a criminal record.
Yeah.
And it seems that his life he's never been in control of his life since then. Whereas Sal and Mueller, while they've had their demons, they've sort of decided where they want to go with them. And I think that, they feel a real debt to him. But there's a really great moment on the train, again, when the guys are talking and they're talking about this incident with the drugs. They're talking about the morphine that they've been given. And one of them is saying, we were given the morphine for helping injured soldiers, and the other guy's saying, no, we were given the morphine for us. Like, they gave it to us.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of almost conspiratorial idea of what the war was, and these people were being completely turned into machines and fed drugs, knowing that they would use them on themselves.
Yeah.
And it's quite a bold anarchic point of view that he has.
Yeah.
But then you've got this really lovely... Well, maybe it's not lovely, but this idea that he is still will always be a soldier.
Yeah.
Despite all the criticisms he has for the military, and he calls colonels out, and he is so rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't shake that it is the thing that defines him as a person. And there's a lot about that, particularly with Sal. He's all about this idea of legacy and...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's people who enjoyed The Post. It's a very different film to The Post, but the two films are definitely covering some similar ground in the fact that people need to be held accountable for, you know, the things that they've done and the things that they've said. And the two films are very different, I think. But they're both still funny in different ways. They're both still looking at the past to kind of figure out the present. And I think people who liked The Post will go into Last Flag Flying and probably find something to love about it as well.
Yeah, I saw this before I saw The Post.
Me too.
But I'd like to see this again, having seen The Post, with that kind of view of what Vietnam War was for the people at home as well. That'd be a nice way to look at it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stephen, you already mentioned this a bit, but the look of the film. So the cinematography was done by Shane F. Kelly, and I agree, it's very sort of somber and cold look. A lot of rain, sort of concrete cities, trains, bad neighborhoods, and that kind of nicely juxtaposed, I guess, with the sort of relationship between them in a weird way, that they're kind of warm together and they warm up together while the rest of the world is gray and cold.
No, I think you're right. Remind me, is the film set at Christmas or New Year's?
I think it is.
Yeah, because sure doesn't Lawrence Fishburne have to get home in time for New Year's or something like that? And I think that that's a massive kind of... Well, no, it's actually a subtle thing, because we end up, you know, setting the film at this time where families are supposed to be together and people are supposed to come together. And yet there's something about the way that it's filmed that still makes it seem so cold. And I think that there's a definite relationship going on between the music of the film and the look of it, and this atmosphere that Linklater cultivates is certainly, like I said, like melancholic. And when you see these guys, I'm a big fan of like trains in films,
right?
Okay. Especially like modern trains, and I think there's nothing more satisfying than watching a group of characters sitting together on a train, yeah, as it's going from one place to another, and they're kind of in stasis and they're in transit, and having to sit together and having,
yeah,
to talk.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, he did the same thing with Before series.
Yeah,
The train plays a huge part in that as well, about like a journey between one place and another. And I think those scenes on the train in that kind of like fluorescent lighting,
yeah,
with them all sat underneath it, so in such close quarters, is really well done. Yeah.
You excited for The Commuter with Liam Neeson?
No, I hadn't even thought about it. Well. I think I'm talking more about less about
Steven,
trains exploding, and more about trains being, yeah, a place of
source, yeah, code's pretty good.
yeah, sure. I think more Eternal Sunshine than Source Code.
Right. And we haven't talked about the fourth member as well of this cross country gang, which is Charlie Washington, played by J. Quinton Johnson. He's the soldier that's accompanying the body as well. And he hasn't been talked about much that I've seen, but he really holds his own against these three actors who are, as we said, great actors playing great roles. So it's quite tough for a younger actor, I,
yeah,
imagine.
The small amount of scenes that he does have with,
yeah,
especially with who does he tell the truth to eventually, about how Steve Carell's son was.
It's Salamula, isn't it?
Salamula.
That's a, yeah, good. That's
they
a kind
of push him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They know that something's wrong, and
yeah,
I think the restraint he shows in that scene is really well done.
Because he's quite a conflicted character as well.
Yeah.
In the same way that they are, I guess, that they're soldiers that have to respect their, mm-hmm, commanding officers, but also are questioning the decisions made from the people at top.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts off, he's almost like a spy sent in by the colonel to make sure he's buried in his uniform, he's told.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he's kind of like, whatever they tell you, you're a soldier, he's a soldier, you do as I tell you. But then as he warms to them, he kind of blends in with their kind of sensibility.
Yeah.
Which is done quite subtly.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I think that he comes across as a friend to Steve Carell's,
yeah,
son as well, without having, you know, his biggest relationship in the film is with a dead boy.
Yeah.
And, you know, when that's what you've got to get across without actually ever even seeing that relationship, I think it's a difficult task. And
absolutely,
I think he does it really, really well. The film doesn't really have any kind of like stakes other than, you know, where does this boy,
no,
end up? Like, where does it finish?
Very Linklater-y, I think, to have,
yeah,
the stakes very low. I can't think of any Richard Linklater film off the top of my head that has massive stakes.
I mean, Celine and Jesse's relationship is like, there's a lot at stake,
yeah,
there, Sam. But no, you're right though. It's still a small thing.
Even something as broad as School of Rock, it's pretty low stakes.
To play, right, the Battle of the Bands.
Got to play, yeah, the Battle, yeah, of the Bands. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, you're right.
So maybe we should end then talking about Linklater.
Mm-hmm.
And because we speaking of S. Craig Zahler at the beginning of the show, when we go and watch Dragged Across Concrete, we're going to have a certain amount of baggage, right, with Brawling Cell Block and Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah.
And with the next Tarantino, we're going to go in with loads of baggage, and the next Spielberg and the next Paul Thomas Anderson film. Often with these auteurs, you go in to watch a film and you are, there's a sort of a context to everything already without even seeing it, and even Three Billboards. It's only Martin McDonagh's third film, but you do go into that thinking of In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths,
yeah,
and how they compare. But with Richard Linklater, I feel there's very little of that. Because his films are so laid back and so simple and so kind of humanistic, I don't feel like there's much kind of pretense laid onto it.
Until recently, I would agree entirely. I think he definitely did that whole one for you, one for me, one for the studio, one for me kind of thing with his career. And the ones for him feel very consistent throughout.
Yeah.
The ones for the studios, they could kind of do anything, like School of Rock.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still got Linklater touch, but put it next to Before Sunrise,
yeah,
and I don't know if this is the same guy.
Yeah.
But I think his career seemed to change for me around, well, Boyhood changed it, and I think he went into doing whatever he wants now. And I think that they're taking it. I think I now would expect
certain
something.
Things. Okay.
The word I would use is gentle. I don't know if that's a bit naff, but there's something calm about him and restrained about him that I think I would expect, and not necessarily be disappointed if I didn't see, but I want to hear his thoughts on life.
Yeah, no, you're that's what he does best though.
Yeah.
Gentle is the right word.
Yeah.
Because even we're saying the film doesn't have stakes. Bernie is a film about a murderer.
Yeah.
But that's a very quaint portrayal of a murderer.
Yeah, no, you're
like
right.
A hugely compassionate portrayal of a murderer. Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that I mean, in its first, it's certainly building up steam now, Last Flag Flying, but it's when the first few like reviews came out from its first screenings, it had a quite a tepid response. And I think that's because after things like Boyhood, and you know, before Midnight and Everybody Wants Some, which were all films that like had a quite they had a hook. You know, they had like an edge, something that you could kind of grab onto. Yeah. Whether it was a, you know, people say the Boyhood was a gimmick. I'm not sure it was, but that kind of gimmicky thing. Whereas this doesn't. This doesn't have that. It seems like a more straightforward kind of drama. But I think people now are expecting Linklater to be kind of to come out with this new great idea on how to portray time and how to portray relationships in this kind of very gentle, measured way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And experiment, because he is an experimental filmmaker, I think, like in a lot of ways. I there's not, you know, apart from maybe Truffaut with his series, nobody had done the Boyhood thing before. And the same goes for the Before series. No one had followed these characters through like 25 years of their lives. And I have no idea what Linklater's doing next. I can't remember reading what he's got on the slate.
I heard rumours of another Before.
Oh. No, it's about another 4 years yet if they're going to follow I think he has to. I think he does have to do another one. Because, I mean, this is what I like about him, is he doesn't shy away from these difficult difficult ideas about where people go and what they do with their lives. Because obviously, you could look at the Before series and say, 9 years down the line, where are they going to be then? Like, why do we care about these characters anymore? And I think Linklater is going to look at that and be like, well, let's find out.
Yeah.
You know, let's find out where they are. Like, instead of being like, we've got nothing else to do with these guys, why don't we just see where they are and why don't we see what they're doing? And with Before Midnight especially, we saw a horrible version of a relationship that we loved so much. And it was painful to watch at times, and a very kind of, I think, a brave thing to do as a filmmaker. And I hope to be seeing more of that from him, to be honest, in the future. A lot more kind of... I loved Last Flag Flying, but I would like for him to push it again.
Yeah.
To push the kind of the envelope a bit further in terms of, like, experimental filmmaking.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so that's Last Flag Flying, which is released Friday, January 26th. But if you feel like staying at home this weekend, or on Monday, the 29th, God's Own Country, the British film that won Best Independent Film at the BIFFAs this year and is nominated for Best British Film at the BAFTAs. That is on Curzon Home Cinema. Ryan, do you want to talk a little bit about God's Own Country?
God's Own Country is one of the best films of the last year. Certainly, possibly the best British film I saw last year. It's very raw. Mm-hmm. It's very... it's kind of brutal in its depiction of Britain, an English landscape, and of... blossoming love in a way. It's really stripped down and it's really kind of physical and rough, but it, you know, it has a real tenderness to it, and the love that you see between the two lead characters it feels very honest, and it does a really interesting thing, I think, God's Own Country, where it sort of sidesteps the usual trappings of a relationship of this kind, where it's not all about the difficulty of them expressing themselves to the rest of the world. There's a difficulty in them admitting to each other that they love each other. These are two men who meet through circumstance on a farm and fall in love with each other. And they go through the usual kind of charade of, do I like you, do I not like you? But once they are together, there are few barriers to them being together other than themselves and their own sense of macho pride, I suppose, is the only real problem. And that's quite refreshing to see, I think. I think it's a really, really terrific film.
All right, great. So that's God's Own Country, which is on Curzon Home Cinema on January 29th. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. If you like the show, please review us on iTunes. It means a lot to us. So it's goodbye from Stephen.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from me. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.